Cigarette maker Philip Morris International has suspended a global social media marketing campaign that used young online personalities to sell its heated tobacco device known as IQOS, an acronym for I Quit Ordinary Smoking. Philip Morris claims to have a strict policy of not promoting tobacco products using young celebrities or models who are or appear to be under the age of 25. Yet, the company had used young social media ambassadors to market its IQOS device.
The U.S. and China appeared deadlocked over trade negotiations Sunday, with the White House bracing itself for potential retaliatory tariffs from Beijing. Just days after the latest round of deal talks collapsed, White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow told Fox News Sunday that a key sticking point was China's refusal to make changes to its laws.
A Facebook co-founder on Thursday called for the company to be broken up. Chris Hughes created Facebook with CEO Mark Zuckerberg at Harvard University. In an essay in the New York Times, he wrote, "The American government needs to do two things. Break up Facebook's monopoly and regulate the company to make it more accountable to the American people." Facebook owns the largest social network with more than 2 billion users across the world. It also owns WhatsApp, Messenger, and Instagram, each used by more than 1 billion people.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Monday. It's May 13th, and it's 5:10 in the morning. Thank you for tuning in for another edition of The Opening Bell. Another business day, another business week getting underway. And there's lots going on in the world of business. We're going to try to bring you up to date on as much of it as we can this morning here on the program. We've got Mary Dwyer with us this morning, the CEO of IES Abroad. Study abroad programs are still very popular and very integral in terms of getting some world global experience good for business as well. Mary is in the PPG Paints Green Room this morning. We'll bring her in for our CEO Spotlight at 5:00, just a couple of more minutes here this morning. A little bit later in the program, a new study by the AAA Motor Club, the American Automobile Association, finds Americans warming to electric vehicles but not ready to buy. We're going to go into the details of that study with Beth Mosier at about 5:38 this morning from AAA. So those are our guests this morning. We'll also keep you posted on the latest news, traffic, weather, and sports as we move forward with this hour this morning. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, the opening bell rings this morning. After a rough week last week on Wall Street, investors have been worried about trade talks between the U.S. and China, along with fresh tariffs on Chinese goods. At the end of the last week, the Dow Jones Industrials managed to rally enough to close 114 points higher. The NASDAQ gained about 6 points. The S&P climbed just 11 points. This morning, futures are pointing toward a negative open on Wall Street. Later this morning, Dow futures off as much as 300 points, nearly a percent this morning, nearly a percent of S&P and NASDAQ futures as well. In Asia overnight, the Hong Kong market closed for a holiday. The Nikkei in Japan off nearly 0.75%, down nearly 154 points. The Hang Seng off nearly 0.75%. The Shanghai off more than 1.25%. And in Europe, markets are mixed. The London market, the FTSE, is a little bit higher this morning, but the DAX in Germany and the CAC in France are off by 0.5% each. Oil is trading this morning at $62.63 a barrel. A couple of stories as we begin this morning. You heard there in the opening montage, trade negotiations with China still front and center for many investors. Those talks are said to be likely to continue when President Trump and the Chinese president attend the next month's G20 summit. Yesterday, the White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow said China had not come far enough on trade negotiations, but discussions will continue. He said the stall came 2 weeks ago when Beijing reportedly backtracked on previous agreements with the White House. On Friday, President Trump raised tariffs from 10% to 25% on nearly $200 billion worth of Chinese imports. Two presidents are scheduled to attend the G20 summit in Japan at the end of June. We're getting some knowledge, some idea of how the Chinese are feeling about this in an editorial yesterday in the Global Times, a daily Chinese newspaper published by the Communist Party. It said the fierce U.S. offensive on trade is irrational, and that the idea China cannot bear a trade war is, in this editorial's report, in this editorial's words, a fantasy and misjudgment. Also this morning, a presidential candidate, Senator Kamala Harris, says it's time to break up Facebook, joining a growing chorus of people who are saying that. California Democrat telling CNN over the weekend that Facebook has experienced massive growth and has prioritized its growth over the best interest of its consumers. We begin this morning with our CEO spotlight. It's one of the nation's oldest, largest, and most academically reputable study abroad programs. This morning, the CEO of Chicago-based IES Abroad is with us. Mary Dwyer is here. Mary, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations. As we start here, you were named to the Crain's Chicago Business Notable Women's List.
Yes.
A very nice list to be added to.
It is. I'm really honored.
Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about IES Global, the history, and where things stand right now with the organization.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, it's a great success story. It started in 1950, started by a Viennese man who'd been in the underground during World War II. And a married couple in the U.S. They were 24 years old. And I have read their letters that they would send back and forth. And they had no business acumen, I hate to say, but mm-hmm. the timing allowed them to start the organization. And their commitment was to change the world through young people understanding other cultures. So 68 years later, it's the largest study abroad organization in the U.S. And we educate over 10,000 international and U.S. students abroad and here also.
Yeah, that's a great statistic. And talk to us a little bit about that. Studying abroad, what it does to the students' experience, and how does it impact them later in life, do you think?
Well, the experience is almost always positive for these students, and I really admire the students because they have to jump a lot of hurdles at their colleges to be able to afford to study abroad and to get abroad, given all the requirements they face at their universities. But our 50-year study, the only one of its type, and several others since that have been career studies, have shown that it has a dramatic impact on their academic success when they come back, their career success in terms of 93% of them get a job within 6 months in their field. After graduating, on average, they'll make $7,000 more a year than other college graduates. And probably the biggest impact is on them personally, on their personal growth. Mm-hmm. So they report being able to tolerate ambiguity more, being much more mature, and really having a worldview that they wouldn't have had if they had stayed in Illinois, for example.
Mm-hmm. The worldview is important because increasingly we are a global society, whether we want to admit it or not. And it's important to be able to have the experience of other people to see mm-hmm. the world in their eyes, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And all these students will probably be working for global companies or organizations, and they need to understand how people in different cultures perceive things, how they work differently, and be able to work in those firms very successfully themselves. But also they need to have a more global view to understand what's going on in the U.S. at any given time in terms mm-hmm. of our government policies, our social policies, and so on.
Does the experience abroad, does it include all of those different facets, government, economy, lifestyle? Are all of those things included in the experience?
Absolutely. So they're taking courses that are taught on-site by local faculty members who are the tops in their particular fields. And those folks are telling them what is the political scene in Spain. But then they are working into the class comparing that with the U.S. or socioeconomic issues or whatever the issues are, climate control mm-hmm. issues, every possible issue you can imagine. They're studying while they're overseas in the context of comparing it with the U.S.
You mentioned Spain there. Is that one of the more popular places for kids to study abroad? What are the top places?
Absolutely. So the UK is always number one. Mm-hmm. Spain, Italy, and France always follow. China changes with the time, interestingly yeah. enough. It was at one point in the top 10. It moved up to about number 5, and it's receding now. But those are most students go to Europe, but they go everywhere in the world.
What are the demographics like? Who are the students that normally do this?
So the majority of students who study abroad are from about 30% of them are students of color, which is a big success, by the way, because the field traditionally did not attract students of color to the experience. They are more likely to be business majors, and they're more likely to be social science majors than any other major. For example, students in the sciences typically don't tend to study abroad. And there's been a big change in the field in that it used to be that only students of high socioeconomic level could study abroad. But thanks to organizations like IES that give over $6 million in financial aid a year, in addition to whatever the federal government and their schools are giving them, that barrier to entry no longer exists in study abroad. So anyone could study abroad if they really wanted to.
Mm-hmm. I know the financial part of this is important for some demographics. You mentioned it there. Recently, there was the announcement that there is going to be a fully funded program for kids who are at a college here in Chicago. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, this was my idea, so I'm tremendously excited about it, of course. Yeah. But I didn't get to study abroad for socioeconomic reasons, and the school I went to, which was in Chicago at the time, only encouraged language majors to study abroad. So I've always been committed to offering as much financial aid as possible and letting underrepresented students study abroad. And ARUPE is a really novel experiment that the Jesuits are doing in higher education, which is making higher ed accessible and affordable. And so I went to the dean, Steve Katsouris, who is a wonderful higher ed leader, and said, we'd like to give you a free program. And it's starting May 19th. So there'll be 10 students who had to compete in order to go, which is a pretty large percentage of their student body at ARUPE. And at all costs are covered. Their airline ticket, their passport expenses, and all the program expenses are covered. And I'm really excited about it because they're all students of color who otherwise, well, would have never gotten out of the state of Illinois and have never been on planes and do not have passports.
Wow. That's amazing. And the title of the program is Culture and Regionalism in Spain. Sounds very exciting.
It is. Since it's based at Loyola, which is a Jesuit university, of course, they are following what's considered the St. Ignatius way. And so they are actually traveling on the east coast of Spain to look at those issues through the eyes of sites that St. Ignatius actually traveled through before he founded the Jesuits.
I'm guessing that this program, you're probably creating a model for other schools too, right? I mean, I would be surprised if this stops at Loyola.
Absolutely. I hope so. I would really like to imitate this model elsewhere because IES, through its strategic success, its nimbleness, its dedication to study abroad, has become a very successful organization, as our statistics show. And so we want to give back to our community, and I hope that we can enlarge that program and offer it at other places too.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. I think back to what you said about you not being able to do study abroad because of socioeconomic reasons. I think that is a very important part of your qualifications for this job. Talk to us a little bit about what that has meant in a real world setting for you as CEO.
Well, I wasn't able to study abroad, even though I grew up middle class in a manufacturing center, but I did work in 7 developing countries early in my career, starting about the age of 25. And that's what triggered my interest in a more global perspective, frankly, and also international education. And every year I made sure I took one of those assignments to either teach or consult abroad. So for me, it was critical to have that kind of background. I understood how life-changing it was, and I wanted to make a commitment to the current generation and future generations. Since study abroad, we know, has not only a transformative immediate impact on people, but it has a very lasting impact on people. And there are very few activities in life that last a lifetime in terms of impact. So I was very thrilled to do it, but it is an extremely complex, volatile market. And very competitive. There is no repeat business, for example, in study abroad. And my dry cleaner has more repeat business than IES does. So it requires a lot of teamwork in terms of management and leadership skill to run an organization that's in study abroad.
Do you have to deal with like other things similar to CEOs elsewhere, like money? I'm guessing money's always a problem, right? Are you always out raising money and doing financial things? And also, I mean, how much do you look at the future and think, okay, here's where I want the program to be in 5 or 10 years? How much does that push you every day?
Well, I tend to be very long thinking as a CEO, so I'm always thinking about that. And the one thing that's kept me at IES year after year, because I get bored easily, is coming up with something new, innovative for the organization to do every year. So I've already got three things lined up for next year, for example, that we're going to be pursuing. And so it's very important to innovate, I think, in any organization, because if you remain with the status quo, you don't really thrive. Money is definitely harder to come by for study abroad, because most study abroad providers are universities themselves. So provider organizations like IES have to be very nimble, have to be careful about their pricing. Our price increases are much lower than higher education's, for example. And we have to make sure that our internal discount rate is not as high as colleges and universities have in order to have a positive bottom line. IES is actually in its fourth record-setting year in terms of enrollment, in terms of net income. And as a not-for-profit, we put that net income back into our programs. And that's wonderful. As an educator, to be able to reinvest in a time in higher education where there's so many cutbacks in universities and universities are having to cut back services to students, we're thrilled to be able to add more.
The political discussion these days about college is that perhaps we forgive some of the debt or all of the debt for some students and also lower the price of college or provide it for free. Are those good discussions to be having, do you think, these days?
I think they're vital discussions to be having, because there's now $1.5 trillion loan debt in this country, which is record-setting and is having incredible impacts on the economy. This generation and the two before them are delaying marriage. They're delaying buying houses. They are in debt well into their 40s. And even more troubling, their baby boomer parents who didn't save money for retirement are now paying off those loans too. So it's absolutely critical that this discussion occur. It's a much larger national issue than most people know. And I think higher ed, frankly, hasn't done a very good job of explaining the huge extent of discounting that occurs inside universities. And so it kind of distorts the topic. Mm-hmm. However, honestly, other than a huge tax increase, I'm not quite sure what's going to change that. And if you look at Europe, where they would say, we have free higher education, they do not have free higher education. They're paying 60-80% tax income taxes, which is paying for higher ed for a few. And so it'll be interesting to see where this discourse goes nationally. But free higher education does not exist without a price associated with it.
How does the student debt equation impact IES? I'm guessing there are a lot of students who are saddled with debt while they're in school who this is not an option for them.
Absolutely. I think it is probably one barrier to study abroad, because the vast majority of private colleges actually charge the students the same amount they would pay on campus to study abroad, even though it's cheaper to study abroad in terms of tuition and housing. And so they already have that expense, which they've probably taken considerable loans out. And let's face it, it's more expensive to be in Paris than Urbana, Illinois, in terms of daily expenses, travel expenses throughout Europe, and so on. And so it definitely is a barrier to entry. And that's why IES gives so much top-off financial aid every year, so that it's not a barrier to those students.
I mentioned in the opening that you were named to the notable women executives over 50 by Crain Chicago Business. What do you think? Why do you think they put you on that list? If you had to give us reasons why, do you think?
I think because of the 730% increase in enrollment in my period of time as the IES CEO, and the fact our revenue has grown 12-fold in my period at IES. So I think those kind of quantitative results get attention. I personally, to be honest, don't like national awards, and I've gotten several. I just got an International Leadership Award last year, because I like to shine the light on other people, because I view it as a team effort. It's not just my effort that has resulted in this success. A lot of really talented people who work for us around the world are part of that. So I'm honored, and I think it's probably mainly because of quantitative results, which are important for sure. But what's more important to me as an educator is that our students are getting the absolute highest quality experience when they're overseas.
As a CEO, and I think this could also go to what we're talking about here. You are very involved in the community. You do all kinds of different things. How important is that to being a successful CEO, to have roots in the community, but also to make an impact in different areas?
It really gives you a perspective, interestingly enough. So I've chaired a lot of boards, not-for-profit boards. I'm on several not-for-profit boards locally. They tend to span all kinds of areas, such as theater and education. And they all have different purposes in terms of the local community. But I think it keeps you in touch with reality. And I think it continues to help me as a CEO to look outside the narrow office that I sit in to what community needs are.
You brought in this morning a really cool magazine that has a wonderful cover on it. It's the Alumni Magazine, 65 years, 65 faces. And I'm looking, trying to look at the different faces on the cover. And the question comes, you know, who are the famous alumni? Are there notable alumni that you can tell us about that have done study abroad, and are there faces here?
Yes, there are large numbers of them that studied abroad with IAS, probably because as an academic consortium, the majority of our students come from wealthy private schools. And as we know in economics, the cumulative advantage or disadvantage depends, you know, kind of formulates where you end up in college. So these are people who probably were fairly advantaged early on in life. But Janet Napolitano, whom we all know, who's now head of the University of California system, but previously served under Clinton. Marianne Peters, a former U.S. ambassador who runs the Jimmy Carter Center in Atlanta. Mark Shriver, Sergeant and Eunice Shriver's son, who's the president of Save the Children Network, and before that he was a House of Delegates member in Maryland, and Richard Blum, who is a billionaire who is married to Senator Dianne Feinstein, who when the first time I met him 10 years ago said to me, I wouldn't be here today if it were not for IAS. And so we have a whole plethora of really successful people who are both on the not-for-profit, government, and corporate level, and they all will tell you how much their worldview changed as a result of studying abroad, which is great because it made them more successful at what they do.
So back to the question of the future.
Yes.
Give us a sense of what you would like this program to become, where you would like to see it in 10 years.
I'd really like it to become larger because the more students who get the opportunity, the better. I would like many more underrepresented students to study abroad. IAS has really committed itself to this in the last 10 years in particular, and we've been hugely successful at increasing minority students and male students who typically do not study abroad. But it's not good enough. We want to make sure that we increase those numbers even more so that it is not simply a white female field and experience. And I would hope that we continue to invest in the academic quality. So, for example, next year we are doing something we did 10 years ago, which is creating a group of educators who will look at all of our curriculum and basically renovate it. And that activity 10 years ago made a huge difference in what we taught overseas and made us much more able to grow, but also gave students a better experience. So those would be just a couple of things, I would say, that I'm interested in see happening. But the organization is always improvising every year and innovating, and that's what's made it successful for so long.
Knowing what I know now and having met you today and had this conversation, if I could go back in a time machine to do this, I would love to. I think for an adult who's in business today, I think it would be a valuable thing to have an adult exchange program as well.
Absolutely. And I think there are programs like that out there that are aimed at retirees for the most part, I think. But if businesses would give their executives leaves of absence, I think it would be really valuable. I meet with CEOs all the time who are constantly looking for people who have a broader perspective. They may not ever post them overseas, but they still know to do their jobs well in the U.S. they need a broader perspective and they need to understand how the world works. And so it would be a great idea for corporations, for example, to fund certain levels of executives getting a short-term experience. We offer short-term experience as well as semester and full-year experiences for students. And some of those are graduate students, particularly business graduate students. And so I think you're on to something. I think that would be a great idea. I think you and I should be the first students.
Yeah, absolutely. I would throw my name in the hat in a moment for
me
that.
Too.
Mary, it's wonderful meeting you. Thank you for coming in today. And we look forward to seeing all the success of IES.
Thank you. It's nice meeting you.
Mary Dwyer is the CEO of IES Abroad. You can find more about them online at iesabroad.org. We're going to continue our conversation with Mary after the bell this morning and post more in our podcast of The Opening Bell at WGNradio.com a little bit later on this morning.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Monday edition of The Opening Bell. A new survey by the AAA Motor Club shows that Americans are not ready to buy electric vehicles in great numbers just yet, and don't think their neighbors are either. The survey talked, though, about improving an improving feeling among some of those people that surveyed about electric vehicles. We want to talk more about that this morning with Beth Mosher of the AAA Motor Club, the public affairs person there, director of public affairs at AAA. Beth, I'll get it out this morning. Good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So the headline here, I was trying to sort of encapsulate the different aspects of the survey here. On one hand, Americans don't seem ready in huge numbers to buy electric vehicles, but they appear to be warming to them.
They are warming to them. I think that's the best way to describe them. Our headline talks about people want to go green, but they're still a little slow to adopt. And a lot of that just comes down to education and people really not having a sense of things like how far can they get on the charge, or how electric vehicles work exactly, what the cost is. So there are still some barriers for people to adopt electric vehicles.
40 million Americans say that they're at least willing to consider it. And we're talking here about a battery electric vehicle, which I guess the it's BEV is what we're going to refer to that as going forward. Talk to us a little bit about the questions that were asked in the survey. And you mentioned there that the warming part of this is that people are starting to understand a little bit about how far these things can go and where to charge them.
Right. Well, we asked them, you know, whether or not they think that the fleet of cars on the road will be electric by 2029. We also asked them, you know, their interest in owning an electric vehicle. We asked them barriers that or concerns they had about buying an electric vehicle. We asked them whether or not they would ever buy an electric vehicle, and then how much they're willing to pay more for an electric vehicle. So it was a range of questions that we asked them in this survey, and it really gives us, we do this survey every year, so it really gives us a trend over the years of whether or not people are warming, as we talked about, to this technology or to this to electric vehicles. We do the same sort of survey with all sorts of, we do this with automated vehicles as well, just to get, you know, where people are in the market and where trends are heading on these topics.
Yeah, and so that gives us a good idea of a good place to go back to and see how Americans are moving along on this. Like, for example, people asked about their concern about not enough places to charge or running out of a charge when driving. Double-digit drops from the last survey.
Double-digit drops, yes, but that's still the one of the big reasons for people not buying an electric vehicle. I think it's, you know, over 57 or so percent. So that's a big barrier for them, is they don't know where they would charge on their daily commute. And then for people who take road trips too, this serves as an impediment to them in taking road trips. So that was one thing that we learned from this survey.
The higher purchase price is obviously a big thing for people as well. Do you think that studies like this give any sort of movement to car companies lowering the price of these? I'm thinking as we move forward, as the price of these cars come down, if that number will change at all.
What we think is, if people can find, you know, our results of this survey, and we produce a green car guide, and it can be found on AAA.com/green car. And there's really, at every price point, if people are interested in electric vehicles, there's something for consumers at every price point. You know, our overall top car that we found was a Jaguar, but, you know, down the price point range, was, you know, best car under $30,000 was a Toyota Camry. We have a pickup, you know, a best green car pickup. So there's really something for somebody at every price point. And then what we find too is that some of the earlier adopters are millennials, which shouldn't be surprising. You know, they're concerned more about concerned less, I should say, about the price point, and concerned more about the environment and those types of things. So, you know, this survey, I think, for us provides a lot of interesting information and interesting tidbits.
Yeah, and on the list of cars there, I know if we've go down the list, I know we've talked about on the program here the Leaf before and the Bolt, the Chevy Bolt. These are cars that have been developed to now go as much as 400 miles on a single charge.
Yes, absolutely. And that's part of that education that we talked about earlier in the show. People understanding, becoming more familiar with the technology and becoming familiar with how far the cars can go on a charge. And also for Chicagoans, interesting information is in stop-and-go traffic, these electric vehicles actually perform very well because when they're decelerating, they're able to kind of regain that charge. So here in Chicagoland, in stop-and-go traffic, which we all face on a daily basis, whether we're commuting or just running errands, these cars perform very well.
I think it's funny, and I know that the survey information that your organization put out, the AAA put out, sort of notes this, but the number of people who think there will be self-driving cars is a little bit higher than those who are comfortable with electric cars. Talk about the disconnect there a little.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, when we asked about the fleet and the expectations for the fleet in 2029, more people, and this was in a separate survey, but more people think that we'll have fully self-driving cars on the roads by 2029 than a fleet of electric vehicles on the road by 2029. And of course, the latter is more likely to happen. So again, there is a bit of a disconnect. It's what we're finding is that the more exposure that people have to this technology, the more they learn about whether it's automated vehicles or electric vehicles, the more comfortable they become and the more of a potential adopter of this technology people can become.
I was surprised to see the number estimated at about 200,000 electric cars on the roads right now. Is that a low number? I was expecting that number to be a little higher.
Yeah, that number does look a little bit low, particularly because almost every automobile manufacturer sells them. But again, I just think it goes back to people being a little bit skittish of this technology, still a little bit slow to adopt, but we believe that information like this is really helpful. And if people, we do know that, as you noted, 40 million Americans are considering, or at least would consider, an electric vehicle for their next car purchase. So we really encourage people to go to their dealership, ask the questions, drive the vehicles, and then between now and when they make their car purchase, determine, you know, where on their route to work could they get a charge if that's a worry for them. But start doing their research now about all of those things, and we think that this number is going to increase in the future.
Well, Beth, we appreciate you being with us this morning to talk a little bit about this. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Beth Mosier, Director of Public Affairs at AAA, and you can find more online at AAA.com. We're going to link out to the results of this study as well on electric vehicles. It's 5:50 now here in the opening bell time to update traffic again this morning. Mary Vandeveld's watching the ride into work. Good morning, Mary.
And good morning. Starting to see some heavy delays, especially traveling outbound on the Kennedy to the airport from the junction. It's about 30 minutes. River Road to Mannheim is especially busy. The inbound side of the Kennedy from O'Hare is not bad, along with the Edens. Inbound Eisenhower 42 from 53, 28 from Mannheim. A tough ride in once you head on to Ida B. Wells. There's a new traffic configuration there, so be aware. Traffic splits to the left and the right. Left traffic goes to Ida B. Wells, and to the right, outbound Kennedy and the outbound Ryan each have one lane. There's one lane. There's actually a center median now to split these two, so it's a little tough heading inbound onto Ida B. Wells. The inbound side of the Stevenson, 28 minutes from the Tri-State, and the Ryan 16 from 95th. Bishop Ford is slow from Cottage Grove, not bad on 57 or on the tolls. Still have an accident north side at Irving Park and Clark. For personalized traffic on demand, get the Traffic Chicago app, approved by the mortgage experts of Team Hochberg. Just search TRAFFIX Chicago. Mayor Vandeveld, WGN Traffic Central.
The John Williams Show.
Wow, those pictures online of that house look great, but the house doesn't really. It's been staged digitally.
Our house.
the art and science and ethics of that at 1:35.
John Williams, this afternoon at 1 on 720 WGN.
Manufacturing is at the heart of our economy in Chicago. As a matter of fact, it's the second largest business sector. Now, we all want to run or manage companies that provide safe work environments and meet government regulations. Luckily, there's a business called U.S. Compliance. It's not a government agency, but they help your company meet the OSHA standards and environmental compliance regulations that you don't have time to worry about yourself. Their goal is to help you keep your workers safe, keep the environment healthy, and make your community a better place. If you're the owner of a small to medium-sized business, or maybe you're the plant manager, or you're responsible for the company's OSHA or environmental regulations, U.S. Compliance is here to make your life easier. They provide comprehensive expertise for a flat monthly fee. They're never going to come in and upcharge you. You know what you're paying. U.S. Compliance has been doing this for over 30 years. Visit them at uscompliance.com. That's uscompliance.com. Or call 888-897-8681. Start spending time on what's going to keep you in business, make you money, and make you happy. It's uscompliance.com, 888-897-8681.
You know that saying, a spring in your step? Do they say that about you? They don't, do they? Because you've got knee pain. And cheerful and youthful as you feel, your knees are keeping you from springing. Well, guess what? The Joint Relief Institute is working on a new saying for you. They treat knee pain quickly and painlessly. They'll get you walking and running and playing and sleeping and getting in and out of your car pain-free. But their new saying isn't ready yet because they can't think of anything to rhyme with advanced digital imaging. That's what they use. They see where your knee is failing, and then they put a joint lubricant into that spot, and it works. You want to bounce around pain free. This process is non-surgical. It's quick. It's pain-free. I'll bet your insurance is going to pay for it, too. Watch the testimonials of people just like you who have knees that did hurt but don't anymore. Go to jointreliefinstitute.com or call 708-888-0000. They've got locations in Orland Park and Oak Brook. Same number for both spots, 708-888-0000. They'll put a spring in your step. And if you can come up with something that rhymes with advanced digital imaging, give them a call. They'd love to hear from you.
Hi, my name's Christina Stumble, and I own Farm Girl Flowers in San Francisco. With my Spark Cash Card from Capital One, I earn unlimited 2% cash back on all my business purchases. Last year, I redeemed $115,000 in cash back. Yeah, $115,000. And that doubled our digital marketing budget for the summer. Thanks to my Spark Card, we had our best summer yet. Imagine what the Spark Card from Capital One could do for your business. What's in your wallet?
Real Capital One customers pay for real stories. Credit approval required.
What if buying a house is like buying a timeshare? A pressure cooker sales presentation with no option for a real estate agent to look over your contract. Nobody should work like that. No inspector to uncover hidden problems. No loan officer to review the terms. You'd never buy a home that way, but that's just what happened. That's exactly how most timeshares are sold, and it's ridiculous. If you're stuck in a timeshare, if you can't sell it, if the resort won't let you out, call Timeshare Exit Team. 844-409-EXIT or timeshareexitteam.com. Again, 844-409-EXIT or timeshareexitteam.com.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures off nearly 1.25% this morning on the Dow, nearly 1.5% on the S&P, and nearly 2% now on the NASDAQ. Dow futures are down 300 points. Heading to the opening bell. Agriculture and Commodities Now. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Well, where do we stand on the China-U.S. trade negotiations? Where we stood a week ago and a month ago and 6 months ago. The latest that came yesterday from Washington and Beijing, the U.S. and China continue at a deadlock over trade negotiations, Washington demanding promises of concrete changes to Chinese law, Beijing saying it would not swallow any, quote, bitter fruit that harmed its interests. Market-wise, a mixed close on Friday in livestock with lean hogs trading lower, cattle and feeder cattle trading higher, and, of course, in the grain market, wheat, corn, soybeans all ended the day and the week lower on Friday. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for Monday, May 13th. This week's release of economic reports starts off today with the Federal Reserve's quarterly survey of consumer expectations. The NFIB Small Business Index comes out tomorrow, followed by retail sales on Wednesday. The report on April sales figures highly anticipated because it could shed some light on whether the slowdown that started in December was just a fluke or the beginning of a worrisome trend. Industrial production data is also due out on Wednesday. Thursday will bring weekly jobless claims numbers along with housing starts and building permits. This week closes out on Friday with the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index for May. And elsewhere today on the earnings calendar, Tencent Music reporting quarterly earnings today after the markets close. The company, which dominates music streaming in China, went public on the New York Stock Exchange back in December. And Uber will enter its second day of trading as a public firm. Shares in the company dropped more than 7% on Friday after disappointing debut. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this Monday, May the 13th.